Now let's go to Between the Covers.
My name is Ed Goldberg, and I'm speaking with Libby Fisher-Hellman. Libby, welcome to KABU.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Been to Portland before?
It's been a long time.
Been a long time.
Yeah.
Okay. The title of your latest book is A Shot to Die For. It's published by Poison Pen Press. Nice people at Poison Pen.
Wonderful people.
Yes. You also used to write for Berkeley Prime Crime. Is that true?
I still do. My paperbacks come out from Berkeley. My hardcovers come out from Poison Pen.
Really?
It's a very nice arrangement. It's unusual, but it's nice.
It is, yeah. I should talk to them about that.
I have the numbers.
Actually, I think I do, too. Your main character is a woman named Ellie Foreman, and she's a video producer. Before we get into the book, tell us a little about Ellie Foreman.
Ellie is of a certain age. She's got a teenage daughter and a senior citizen father. She's divorced. I created her to be really an every woman. I wanted a lot of people to, I wanted her to have appeal to intelligent women everywhere, and men, if they want to. So I purposely didn't want to give her any special skills. I didn't want to make her a professional PI, or certainly not a police officer, or any kind of law enforcement person, because I wanted her to use her wits and her ingenuity. At the same time, though, I wanted her to be a real person with real problems. She's in the sandwich generation. You know, she's got pressures on both sides, on both generations. She's divorced, and she's trying to make ends meet because her ex-husband isn't so great with his child support payments. And he also hangs around in every book, much to her chagrin. But I wanted her to have the widest possible appeal that she could.
Mm-hmm. Well, her saga continues from book to book. I've read two of your books now, and she has the same kind of problems in each book. A new man comes into her life, maybe, yes, no, and she's got ex-boyfriends and ex-husbands to deal with, along with a far too intelligent and smart-mouthed teenage daughter.
Funny about that.
Yeah, and her father is he's in an old age home. Is that the,
well? He's in an assisted living.
He's
old, he's frail, but he's basically okay, and he's got every brain cell he was ever born with, which also gives
Ellie another smart mouth.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
So Ellie's kind of right in the middle, trying to deal with it all.
There's another thing about Ellie that's interesting, is that she's Jewish and has a real Jewish life.
She does, and that was very important to me for personal reasons. At the time I started writing fiction, my family was observant. My son actually was Orthodox, and only recently has moderated back to the mainstream. So I went on a personal journey myself. I was born Jewish, but I wasn't observant, and I learned a great deal about my religion, and I'm very proud of what I learned. And although I don't practice everything that I learned, I wanted to share a little bit of it with other people.
That's interesting, because the two most observant Jews I know are both converts. So Ellie Foreman is one of those people to whom things don't necessarily happen to her, but she's always around when something happens. It seems that way. She's like some kind of a cosmic nexus.
A cosmic sponge.
Stuff happens to her. Stuff happens to people standing next to her. In this case, there's a woman named Daria, who her cell phone craps out. They're in the middle of nowhere between Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, which is what, a resort community?
It's a luxury resort. It's where all the rich Chicagoans went after the Chicago fire in the 1800s. Their houses burned down, and they needed some place to live while they were rebuilding. So they all went up to Lake Geneva, which is about 50 miles outside of Chicago, and built these magnificent mansions around the lake and fueled this culture of class and privilege, which to some extent still exists today. Over the years, it's kind of dwindled down, and there are the haves and the have-nots, and the people who buy and the people who serve the people who buy, and that kind of thing. So it's an interesting place of lots of contrasts.
Is there no middle class in Lake Geneva? Is it strictly the people, the rich people, and the people that serve them?
Basically, yes. There, although there are people that have crossed classes now, realtors and politicians, and it's its own community. It's grown quite a bit over the past, let's say, 20 years or so.
And it's not saying too much or giving away too much of the plot to say that a lot of what goes on in this book involves the relationships among the classes.
Yes. This was a little departure for me. I wanted to write a novel that was a little more traditional. You said you'd read my other books. My first three books deal more with issues and social issues and suspense, and hopefully it's all mixed in a wonderful stew that you can't put down and that you want to turn the pages. But in this particular novel, I wanted to kind of pull back and just deal with good old family secrets and secrets and that have been held for 30 years and how they affect the present.
Mm-hmm. And there's, aside from the normal chaos in her life and in her family, Ellie gets into at least two other families who are, in fact, even more chaotic than hers.
Yeah, isn't that nice? It's really reassuring to know that other people have problems that are as severe or worse than yours.
I'd like everybody listening to this to know that. No matter how crazy you think your family is, there's somebody crazier.
Right.
Yes.
Right. And that's really one of the things that that I like to deal with.
Also, I like the way you do cops, because the cops are usually more realistic than cops in a lot of books. Cops have a job to do. It's not a pleasant job. They basically collect garbage for our society, and they get no bennies from it, except the fact that if they don't get too badly shot up, you know, they can at least have a decent retirement. But they like all the help they can get. I mean, they can't give away anything to because it's against the law, frankly, for them to talk about ongoing investigations. But they don't mind getting a little help from amateurs.
They don't mind, but at the same time, the amateur has to know their place. You know, the amateur
which
can
Ellie
go,
doesn't, of course.
Which Ellie doesn't or doesn't want to accept because of whatever issue is really pressing in on her. But, it was very important to me that I get it right. I'm not a police professional, but, you know, when you start writing mystery, you know you have to do your research because you know there are people that are reading you that do know what's going on, and they'll throw your book against the wall if it's not right. So I have gone out of my way to befriend police officers in the North Shore village that I live in outside Chicago, as well as in Chicago, because you never know quite where Ellie's going to end up, as well as the jurisdictions wherever she's visiting. So in terms of Lake Geneva, I talked to Illinois State Police, who monitor the highways between Chicago and Lake Geneva. I talked to Wisconsin police officers. I talked to the former police chief of Lake Geneva, who was also the mayor, who was also in the fire department. So, you know, it was one of those. He knew everything there was to know about Lake Geneva, and we had a couple of very long conversations, and I went up there and visited him, and he took me around.
Yeah, it's one of the first things I do with a new book is I look at the acknowledgments page, mm-hmm. and there doesn't seem to be any decent research. Then I wonder about the book. But, of course, the other thing is if you actually see the research while you're reading it, then the book becomes just fairly boring. Because it's all research and no story.
Yeah, it has to be handled carefully. It brings up something that I do want to mention. When you talk about research and making sure you get it right, I believe that I have an implicit contract with my readers. There is a device to get someone into a murder mystery. A video producer does not come up against dead bodies, but Ellie does in every single book. So I realize that when a reader starts one of my books, they are willing to suspend their disbelief to the extent that they'll say, okay, Ellie will come up against a dead body, and that's going to launch her into an investigation. If they're willing to do that, from that point on, I feel it's implicit. I feel it's required of me that I give them the most authentic, credible read I possibly can from that point on. So that's not only in terms of the research and the police procedure, but also in the character development and the plot development. Character, in my book, in my mind, character drives plot. So what happens has to be natural. It has to be authentic. The plot has to evolve in a way that you'll say, yeah, I can see her doing that, and I can see why she might think that, and I can even see her going to this place to find out more. Because I never want anyone to throw my books against the wall and say, ah, that would never happen.
Yeah, and you get letters, too.
Yeah.
Dear Sarah, I still do. Yes. Dear Sarah, Madam, I enjoyed your book very much. However, on page 47, it says.
Right.
Yeah, right.
But even more than that, you know, there are some books that you just say, oh, that just isn't believable. This person wouldn't do that. And I don't want that to happen in my...
Let me ask you a question, though. When the first time I actually tried to write a novel that I finished, I was really antsy about writing women characters because I said, what do I really know about how women would react in a situation like this? So one of the things I did was I ran it by one of my women friends whose opinion I respected, and she said, it's fine. You're just working from your feminine side anyway. Do you feel that way about the writing men characters?
In a way, it's gotten easier. The irony is the first book that was published was not the first book I wrote. It was the fourth book I wrote. And two of the four books I wrote prior to that actually featured two male detectives, police detectives. And they were police procedurals, which is kind of ironic since I'm not a police officer. And last time I looked, I'm not male. I had some problems with that point of view. In fact, I'm in a writer's group, and they're wonderful, and I'll be in there until the day I die. But at one point, you know, you read your 6 or 8 or 10 pages, and then everybody critiques you. And someone said, you know, Libby, a police officer would not walk into the house and notice the curtains in someone's living room.
A gay police officer. You know?
Who knows? But anyway, so I kind of learned, you know, how to deal with it in craft issues. And now it is easier. And I do let my male side come out more often.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe that suggests the question then, why mysteries to begin with? I mean, what motivated you? You could be writing anything.
Yeah.
You could be writing historical novels. Why mysteries?
Oh, boy. There's a lot of reasons. First of all, I love reading suspense. I have always loved suspense. It takes you away in a visceral way, in an emotional way that a lot of other genres, a lot of other types of literature just doesn't. So I was predisposed toward that anyway. The idea that there is order in the world which is quickly upset by a murder is just riveting to me. It's just wonderful to explore the chaos that ensues once a murder occurs, whether it's a murder on a large scale or a murder in a small community. Everything goes upside down. People act weird. People do strange things. Evil comes out. And then it's the sleuth's responsibility to restore order. And I love that at the end of a mystery, justice is served. It may not happen happily. I mean, the PI might go off into the sunset bitter and having lost his job and lost his girlfriend. But justice has been served, and we can all go to bed and sleep a little more soundly, at least for one more night. And so those dual attractions of suspense and the idea of justice and chaos being dealt with were very attractive to me. So I think that's why.
I'd like to remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Libby Fisher-Hellman, and she is the author of A Shot to Die For, published by Poison Pen Press. Poison Pen Press. Nice people again. I guess I said that twice now.
Yeah, did you hear that, Barbara and Rob?
One of the things I like about Ellie is that she's very insecure. And, I mean, that's not necessarily a great thing to be, but she's beset. Her personal life leaks into her investigations of the crime. The investigations of the crime leak into her personal life. Her daughter says, what are you, crazy doing this again? Her father says, am I going to have to get a phone call one day saying I have to come down and identify your body? She has I can't remember her friend's name.
Susan,
the really smart one who is always, she's like her Jiminy Cricket.
Right, exactly. She's her foil.
Yeah, and she always, they go out for coffee or whatever it is, a glass of wine, and she says, why are you doing this? You know, you said you were going to. You said you were not going to do this anymore, and here it is. Blah blah blah. That strikes me, if not as real, or at least seemingly real, that people have complicated lives. The trouble with the old PIs, the old Raymond Chandler types, is that they were closed in. They were insular. They had nothing. Nothing touched them.
Mm-hmm.
They moved through life without getting any on them if they could help it. That was their whole thing. Is not getting anything. But geez, Ellie wallows in everything.
Right. Well, she is a person. She's got her flaws. She's got her strengths. And as I said, I wanted to write a book that would appeal to a lot of people. I wanted to make her a real person. Someone that, you know, someone once told me, the way you know that you like someone is if you want to go out to lunch with them. And I wanted to make Ellie the type of person that readers would like to go out to lunch with. Maybe not. They may not want her life, but they'd like to go out to lunch with her. They'd like to, you know, pick her brain and share her angst at least for an hour and a half.
What happens to, well, it doesn't happen to Ellie. It happens next to Ellie. It's right at the beginning of the book, so again, I'm not giving anything away here. She meets this woman named Daria. And Daria's cell phone craps out. She needs to borrow a cell phone, and she's very upset about something. It seems like she's having a fight with a boyfriend or something, and Ellie, of course, being a yenta, has to listen in on the whole thing, but then feels a compulsion maybe to kind of talk to her and make her feel calm her down a little bit.
Right.
Because she seems...
It's the mother in her.
She seems viscerally upset, you know? And then the next thing she knows, this woman is shot dead right next to her.
Correct.
Yes. And... to complicate matters, there have been sniper shootings in the area.
Right.
Yeah.
So is this another sniper shooting? Is it a copycat? Or is it something else? And for, you know, half the book, well, for most of the book, the police don't think it's anything more than a copycat sniper. And they're bound and determined to prove that that's the case.
How did you know about Jimmy Pearsall?
He's an old family friend.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful. Jimmy Pearsall was a ball player for the Red Sox and other teams.
Yes.
And he was considered flaky.
Colorful.
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 Yeah.
Yes. Euphemism.
Nowadays he would have issues, but in those days he was considered colorful. And one of my favorite things he ever did was when he hit a home run, he ran around the bases backwards.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Jimmy Pearsall was great. Just to show what kind of a person Jimmy Pearsall was, when they did Cole Porter's life story, Cary Grant played him. When they did Jimmy Pearsall's life story,
Tony Perkins
played
him. Fear Strikes Out.
That's right. Right. That was the title of his book. So Jimmy Sclerides, is that my saying that name?
Jimmy Sclerides.
Sclerides. I'm sorry, I left out a syllable. He's the sheriff of this little Lake Geneva town.
He's the police chief.
Police chief,
right.
Sorry, yes.
Right.
Sheriff would be a county.
Right,
right, yeah.
Correct.
And he's friends with a guy named Luke Sutton.
Mm-hmm.
Luke Sutton is an interesting character. Tell us a little about Luke Sutton.
Luke is the son of one of the rich people in Lake Geneva. His grandfather actually started a company that made automatic railroad couplers. And he is due to inherit the company. Although he's somewhat of a rebel, he left Lake Geneva when he was young. He wanted to do something on his own. He didn't just want to follow in the family's footsteps. And he's always been a rebel. He flies a plane, which, of course, Ellie can't stand to fly. It's a control issue. And he becomes a possible suspect, in Ellie's mind at least, in the death of Daria at the rest stop, because she finds out that they had been seeing each other. So when she meets him, actually he almost runs her down in his plane on the runway of the Lake Geneva resort. There's this landing strip, and Ellie is producing a video at this resort and doesn't know that the landing strip is still in use, and a plane comes down and it's him, and Jimmy Sclerides is in the plane with him, and they're best buddies. And Ellie, of course, thinks, well, you know, power corrupts, and here's the richest guy in town with the police chief, and they're in each other's pockets, and so she's somewhat skeptical of both of them at first.
Yeah, she also runs into Kim Flynn, who's Daria's sister,
mm-hmm.
who also an interesting character, because she's at the same time grieving and angry and also needy. She has her own issues about that. She was always second to Daria, the beautiful one.
Right. Daria was the younger sister. Kim was the older sister. Kim had to do all the dirty work, and Daria got all the praise. Daria, their family owned a restaurant in town, and still does, a Greek restaurant. And believe it or not, there really are little pockets of a Greek community up in Lake Geneva, and there are two Greek restaurants up there. And Jimmy Sclerides, in real life, the former police chief owns the other one. So I wasn't straying too far from the truth there. But Kim does have issues. She's the one that's still working in the family restaurant, while Daria has illusions and ambitions about becoming a chef and is working in the finest restaurant in town as a sous chef.
Mm-hmm.
So
now, the two families, the Flynns and the Suttons, in some way mirror one another.
Yes.
In fact... I was thinking that the rich family, the Suttons, they had a daughter who died under mysterious circumstances years before.
Right.
And the other family, the Flynns, the father disappeared under mysterious circumstances years before.
Exactly.
One family is very wealthy, one family is very poor, and yet they're connected because everybody in this town is connected.
Right. Whether you're rich or poor, in or out, have or have not, there's a connection. And that's why Ellie is, even though she's dealing with both segments of the of society in different areas, she's still an outsider because she's not from Lake Geneva. She hasn't been there. One thing that we haven't mentioned is that 30 years before, before the father disappeared and before this Sutton girl was found dead, there was the resort that Ellie's filming at used to be the Playboy Club of Lake Geneva.
I forgot about that.
And it's a thinly veiled version of what was the Playboy Club, but it was a place where everybody worked during the summer. The teenagers would take jobs there. And people told me about what they did there, and one of them actually managed the landing strip. Somebody else helped the landscapers. Somebody else was a maid there. And so these adults that Ellie is dealing with were teenagers 30 years ago. So there's a little bit of element of that, too, that, you know, we don't go back to the past, but we bring back the life of the Playboy Club and certain seeds of what become the present circumstances were sown during that time.
David.
David. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, one of the reasons I'm not, I'm trying to tread lightly on the plot here is because I don't want to give anything away. You know, any of these.
I appreciate
that.
Yeah,
okay, yeah. That's why I'll let you say what
David,
you want about the plot.
David is Ellie's boyfriend. Sometimes it goes well, sometimes it doesn't go well. The course of true love just doesn't run smoothly for Ellie. Her experience.
They broke up in the last book.
And he, he's trying to patch it back together, and Ellie's not so sure. So they're sort of they're walking around each other very delicately and trying not to tread heavily. And then, of course, someone new comes into her life, and so there's the conflict of what's going to happen to David and what should she do and how does she feel about this new guy who has issues, as we say.
Mm-hmm.
So, but David has been in every book. And in the first book, An Eye for Murder, he was very important. In fact, he was really part of the plot. So, he's an interesting character. But we'll see.
You got an Anthony Award nomination for An Eye for Murder.
I did.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
It's an honor even to be nominated.
It is an honor to be nominated.
Yeah.
And my second book, A Picture of Guilt, was a finalist in the Benjamin Franklin Awards, which is in mystery suspense, which are given by the Publishers Marketing Association, I believe.
Okay. This little town of Lake Geneva, like all little towns, has its secrets. Only an outsider can unravel these secrets because nobody in town will speak about them.
Right.
For one, whatever reason or another, because of involvement or because of shame or because it's our business and nobody else's business.
Mm-hmm.
What fascinates, I mean, you're from Chicago, you lived in Washington, D.C., you lived in New York. What fascinates you about this small-town milieu, this kind of, the omerta that goes on in there?
How do you crack it?
Yeah.
That's really what's fascinating. And even in a small village where, you know, I've lived in a small village outside Chicago for about 20 years now, and I'm not even considered an insider. The people that have lived there for generations, and it's a bedroom community of Chicago. People are in and out all the time. Lake Geneva is even more insular because it's been around for, you know, over 100 years, and families can trace their histories back. And there is something very tempting about wanting to pierce the armor of a small town. You know, they do take their bad boy. You know, they do take their if someone does evil, it's their bad boys, and it's not your bad boys. And we can do what we want with them, but they're still ours, and they're not yours. So there's something very tempting about wanting to get to the bottom of all that.
I had a friend from upstate New York whose grandfather moved up there in the 1890s.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the second generation born in that town, and they were still referred to as the new people.
Right, right.
So what's next? What are you working on now?
Well, that's interesting. You had mentioned you read my third book, An Image of Death, and
right.
When we were talking about police officers before, I almost brought her up. There is a female police officer in An Image of Death who's a very important character. Her name is Georgia Davis, and she and Ellie are working the case sort of in parallel track, and they end up coming together. And, of course, they don't trust each other because Ellie doesn't like cops because she's a child of the 60s, and Georgia doesn't like her because she's interfering. But they do establish a trust with each other toward the end of the book. I've known Georgia ever since I was writing those police procedurals that were never published. Mm-hmm. She was in them. And I always knew that at some point she was going to say, I want my own book. And she did at the end of An Image of Death. So I'm not giving away the plot to say that she was suspended because she did something during the course of An Image of Death that was not permissible. So while she's deciding whether she's going to stay on the force and whether the force is deciding whether to bring her back, she's working as a private investigator. And I'm about 50 pages away from the end of that book. It's called Easy Innocence. It's also set on the North Shore of Chicago. Georgia is a PI, and it's a darker book. Mm-hmm. I tend to like to go lighter, darker. I'm realizing that's my pattern. So this is pretty dark. And when I'm finished that, I think I'll be ready to go back to Ellie.
One more question. What's Ellie's fixation with Grace Slick?
It's her youth. It's a time when she was carefree, when she was young, and when young people felt that when our generation, we all came of age of the 60s, we thought we were going to change the world, and it was going to be a better world, and it was going to be a world where pretense wasn't admissible, where we were allowed to do what we wanted to do, where people would respect everyone, where there would be true diversity instead of just calling it diversity. So it's harking back to a time of possibility.
Boy, they showed us, didn't they?
They sure did, didn't they?
Okay, it's been delightful talking to you. I've been speaking with Libby Fisher-Hellman. She's the author of A Shot to Die For and a 2003 Anthony Award nominee for An Eye for Murder. Congratulations on that. Again, the book is published by Poison Pen Press. So please come back with Georgia Davis.
Thanks, Ed. I will. Okay.
listening to KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM. It's 9:31. Still to come on the Radio Zine at 10 o'clock, Kathleen Stevenson speaks with Reverend Dr. Barbara Rossing, author of The Rapture Exposed, The Message of Hope in the Book of Revelation, which debunks the right wing's interpretation of the last book of the Bible. And at 10:30 on stage and studio, topics include Tears of Joy Theater's The Monkey King and Demoliayo's Paint Mixers. Up next, it's Black Book Talk with guest Dr. Manning Marable, author of the new book, Living Black History.